This is Radio EcoShock with Alex Smith.
We know our daily lives add carbon relentlessly to the atmosphere. And I know this isn't what anybody wants to talk about, but what if millions of helpless people die because we won't change? Michael T. Clare says we may bear the guilt of climate genocide. Clare is a long-standing professor of peace and world security studies at four New England colleges and the University of Massachusetts at Amherst. In 2008, I interviewed him for his book Rising Powers, Shrinking World. He's the defense correspondent for The Nation magazine, often posts on Tom's Dispatch and Salon magazine. His latest there carries the headline, Climate Change as Genocide, but the international response is essentially a shrug of indifference. Michael Clare, welcome back to Radio EcoShock.
A pleasure to be with you today.
Michael, what spurred you to write this uncomfortable article about climate genocide?
I've been seeing signs of or reading about the famine now underway in three countries in Africa and in Yemen and the Arabian Peninsula. I read that 20 million people are at risk at dying now at this very moment, over a million of them young children, because they lack access to adequate supplies of food and water. The UN is trying to save these people and has the tools to save them, and yet the international community is doing nothing to provide the UN with the necessary funds to go forward. They're just turning their backs on these starving, unfortunate people. And this is bad enough. We should be ashamed of ourselves, the international community writ large. But I fear that this is a sign of what climate change will look like, where the numbers will be much greater, and that is the numbers of people facing starvation will be much greater, and a large number of us in the more affluent countries will be doing whatever it takes to preserve our way of life and ignoring those who are suffering. So that's what prompted me.
Well, this isn't an inconvenient truth, as Al Gore talked about. This is a horrible truth. Do we really have to think about this right now? We've got other problems.
Of course. I want to raise it because I think that people who care about the environment and climate, and there are many, many of those around the world. I know so many in my own town, Northampton, Massachusetts, a town of 30,000. There are hundreds of thousands of us who are protesting all the time about the climate. So I know there's an awareness of climate change and the environment. What I fear is that people don't grasp the nature of its impact. We worry about eroding seashores. We worry about burning forests, about endangered species. All of these things are good and proper things to worry about. I fear that we don't grasp the fact that the biggest victims of climate change are going to be human societies. And by the nature of things, and this is very clearly reflected in the scientific literature, and I hope you'll ask me about that, by the nature of things, those who will suffer the most and the earliest will be poor people in the developing world, and poor people in the developed world, for that matter, indigenous people, very poor people, people of color. But on a world scale, it's going to be poor and disadvantaged people in the developing world who will suffer the first, who are suffering now from climate change, and will suffer the most. And this is clearly demonstrated by the scientific literature.
Well, you've opened that can. Let's have a look. What does the scientific literature predict will happen and where?
The scientific literature is very clear that areas closer to the equator, by and large, and the Arctic, or the two poles, will suffer the most. Fortunately, not so many people who live in that. Nobody lives. Very many people live in the Antarctica, and not too many people live in the polar, North Polar region. Those who live there are already facing very severe consequences of climate change. their villages are melting away. Their permafrost is melting. That's demonstrable. The species they depend on are dying off. So their lives are already at risk, and mainly those are indigenous peoples. So that's clearly demonstrable in the scientific literature. But fortunately, the numbers in the polar regions are few. But the most severe impact of climate change is going to occur in the equatorial regions, the tropics and the subtropical areas, because this is where you have large populations that depend on rain-fed agriculture to survive. And the rain is going to disappear in many of these areas, and with it, water is going to disappear, and the ability to produce food is going to disappear, and the crops are going to wither in the increasingly higher temperatures. So some numbers of billions of people whose livelihood depends on agriculture, they're already facing extreme stress. And you look towards the middle of the century, and some of vast areas of agriculture are going to collapse. Now, we know what the consequences of that are. Hungry, miserable people are going to migrate to the cities, and they're desperately going to try to get into Europe or wherever they can, and conflict will ensue.
Well, your article sort of twigged me to another point, which is that these people that we're talking about are depending on rain-fed agriculture. I was thinking about the California drought, and California was able to keep going because they have the dams and all the profits of decades of fossil fuel development to keep them going. But these, you know, where the rain doesn't come, people die.
Absolutely. Or in sad cases, they fight. They fight over what little water there is. And that's proving to be the case in large swaths of Africa in the area known as the Sahel, the southern fringe of the Sahara Desert. This is in places like Mali and Chad and Ethiopia and Sudan. In one country after the other, you have intense conflicts underway that are typically described as ethnic conflicts because typically it involves clashes between Arabic herders, pastoralists, and other groups, Christian groups who are farmers. And the land that the herders depend on is being desertified. Now, before our eyes, the Sahara is growing every year by miles and pushing the herders further south into the land occupied by Christian farmers or traditional Africans and producing clashes all across the African continent.
I have to say my first reaction to your article in Ceylon was that I really didn't want to talk to you about it because I kept coming up with objections that would make it not my fault that all this is happening. And I think right-wing radio listeners must be saying, well, why didn't you count population? I mean, the population in all four of those countries that you wrote about have quadrupled since 1960. I mean, if they can't control their population, why is it our fault?
Now, first of all, let me clarify. You used the word guilt early in your introduction, and I'm uncomfortable with that word. First of all, the guilt, I believe, falls on those who are perpetuating the fossil fuel era at a time when we know that its effects are going to be devastating and lethal. So many of your listeners, I'm sure, are doing whatever they can to reduce their fossil fuel consumption. And what I said in my article is that inaction equals extinction, annihilation. It's those who are perpetuating this system who I think are guilty, not those who are active in the struggle to slow it down and to reverse its effects. So the question is, what efforts are people taking on their own behalf? And population is not responsible for climate change. What's responsible for climate change, overwhelming percentage of it, more than 70% is the consumption of fossil fuels. And sheep herders in Africa do not contribute 1 gram of fossil fuels from the consumption of fossil fuels to global warming. So they're not responsible.
And it seems like reading the United Nations reports, herding big numbers of people into camps for aid can be another bridge to mass deaths, but this time by disease. What happens there?
This is an old story, and it's a human story that we know from the Dark Ages, from the Black Death period in Europe, when many people are confined in close spaces with improper sanitation, and disease comes, and you have a breakdown of the health system, and people have malnutrition to begin with, it's easy for diseases to spread. But, as I note, and what the scientific literature shows, is that climate change is going to make disease, epidemic diseases, much, much worse, because a lot of the disease vectors, like the mosquito in particular, love hot, moist weather, and that's what we're going to get from climate change. Their range is going to grow. So, like the Zika epidemic is not going to be confined to traditional tropical areas, because we're going to become the tropics far to the north as a result of climate change.
That's so true. And you write, too, another key point that refugees from collapsing social systems and dying ecosystems, they get hit again when they move towards urban centers, especially near the seacoast. Could you talk to us about that?
Yes. This is something that I learned from reading the reports of the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, the IPCC. They note that one of their big worries is that more and more people in the developing world, in Asia, Africa, and Latin America, and the Caribbean, are moving from the interior of their country because they can't farm anymore because it's too hot and dry, and they're moving to the cities. And for the most part, the cities in these countries, think of Lagos, Jakarta, Manila, are on the coast, right on the coast. That's because that's where the trade lines are, the sea lanes, the airports, the globalization, all of that's where they hope there might be jobs for them. There are no jobs in the interior, so they flock to the coasts. But that's where climate change in the form of sea level rise is going to be most devastating. A lot of those cities in the developing world are at sea level, and they're going to be wiped out in the next 50, 100 years as sea level rises. And what's typical in all of these cities, so the literature shows, is that the wealthier you are, the higher up you are, the further from the areas that are most at risk, for the most part. And it's poor people who live in the floodplains and in areas that are regularly flooded, because those are the less desirable areas. So all these people moving from the interior can't afford to live in the upper-class residential areas, and they build shanty towns in the floodplains, and these are the areas that are going to be wiped out.
In an article published March 27th in the New York Times, reporter Jeffrey Gettleman writes, after Somalia's last famine, the multi-billion dollar aid industry thought it had come up with an answer to prevent the next one, resilience. It was the new buzzword in aid circles, bandied about at workshops and among high-powered officials, end quote. I wonder if that hip Western concept can really work when we're starting from the ground up in so many countries.
I think this remains to be seen. There are many NGOs, non-governmental organizations, working with farmers and cooperatives in the developing world in Africa to try to develop sustainable agriculture where water is scarce, to switch from water-intensive crops to less demanding crops, to adjust. I think a lot of these projects show promise, They need much more investment than they're getting. They need more government backing and infrastructure assistance. So it's possible. But the bottom line is that the international community is not putting the kind of money into this to make it possible.
You are involved with Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith. My guest is Michael T. Clare, the Five College Professor of Peace and World Security Studies at Amherst, Massachusetts. We're talking about our ugly role for mass climate-induced deaths of the world's poorest people. And Michael, I'd like to return to the central thrust of your recent article in Salon on climate genocide, but to get there, I want to take a detour through your expertise on peace, which you've taught to a couple of generations in New England. Do you think America is at risk of entering another major war?
I worry very much that we're in a new period where a major war is possible again. This is not something we've thought about in recent years. When we think about war today, for the most part, we're thinking about small wars, localized wars, counterinsurgency wars, counterterrorism, what we see in civil wars, what we see in Iraq, Syria, and Afghanistan. And we've lost any memory. My students certainly don't have any memory of the Cold War period when war between great powers involving nuclear weapons was considered a real possibility. That memory is now gone. But I fear that we're entering a period in which those kind of wars are a very real possibility and can start almost momentarily. We have forces poised in the South China Sea, in the Korean Peninsula, in Europe, in the Baltic region, poised on very high alert for a possible clash that could escalate very rapidly into a big war. And I think as a result, we have to reanimate the kind of peace movement that you had during the Cold War period. That's going to be a tough slog.
Well, I think war will come, but not necessarily because of Trump's misjudgment or the too many military men in the new administration. It may come from below. I'm thinking in America, one-third of men 18 to 31 are living in their parents' homes. Many are not working or going to school. When they wake up from video gaming, they're shut out of the dream of consumerism. And that sounds like the kind of material we need to make a so-called popular war. What do you think?
I know people worry about that a great deal. I don't worry about it really the way you say. Maybe I should worry about it some more. I think there's some concern about that. I think any young man in America who wants to get a job can find one. They may have to move. There's a tragedy there. What's happening in places like West Virginia and Wyoming and the Dakotas is that young people who have any ambition are moving to the coasts or to Chicago where there are jobs and high-paying jobs for talented young people, abandoning the cities and the hinterlands. And there is a sadness to that. But I don't see what you're talking about. What I worry about is the flashpoints where you have a rising China confronting an America in decline, where you have Russia trying to flex its muscles and NATO worried about its decline and one side or the other making a miscalculation. So I worry about muscle flexing and miscalculation leading to war.
I've been looking at lectures about the Crimean War, the Civil War, World War I, and I kept asking myself, why do millions of healthy young men want to throw their lives away in mass suicide? And for me, that cycles back to the whole question of mass deaths as the climate becomes more uninhabitable. Maybe that same hysteria for mass death is operating right now, helping to empower climate denial and inaction. What do you think?
Oh, my gosh. I can't speak to North Korean soldiers, because they have been indoctrinated since birth into an extreme form of nationalism around a personality cult, and their thinking may be different. I don't think young men and women in uniform in the United States or Russia or China have that kind of death wish. I really do not think that. I think they have a naive belief, and that's what worries me, is the naivete that their leaders are sane enough to avoid accidental clash from escalating. It's the leadership lack that I worry about, that our leaders are not capable of managing a crisis when one arises.
Well, given what you've done and written about peace, do you think there's a role to start talking about climate peace?
Yes, I think that's right. I really do. I think that, personally, I believe the biggest obstacle to progress on climate change is going to be new Cold Warism. Because the revival of the Cold War, which we're seeing before our eyes, and this preceded the election of Donald Trump, by the way, and I think would be underway even if Hillary Clinton was president. I think we would have this creeping Cold Warism between the U.S. and Russia. I think that atmosphere, and with China, and with North Korea,
and Canada,
and Canada, thus revival of, well, I call it Cold Warism, of hostility, suspicion, cyber warfare now added to the mix, show of force, muscle flexing, is going to create an international environment in which progress on climate change will become increasingly difficult. And that's what worries me. So if you care about climate change, which I know my students do passionately, they cannot avoid the war and peace equation.
So honestly, if we don't take meaningful climate action, and we're not right now, how bad do you think mass deaths will get and how soon? Is a great die-off possible?
I believe that we will see a planet which will be which will witness a lot of misery and suffering and unnecessary death.
Do you cringe a little inside when you work through what that really means?
I do. I don't think I'm saying anything unique or original here. I think anybody who picks up the reports of the IPCC, the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, or any of the scientific literature, and reads it through, which I've done, and puts two and two together, you know, the two is that the climate is going to make food production increasingly difficult in large parts of the world. That's the two. And the second two is that people will not be able to feed themselves in large numbers, and 2 and 2 equals 4 is there's going to be large-scale starvation. I think that's inescapable from what we're seeing before our eyes.
Well, here's the conundrum for me, and it's that the climate threat could help generate a lot of other difficult problems to the point where people demand a strong man, they demand a military government, and yet it seems so evident that only a real, actual functioning democracy could save us from climate change. What are your thoughts?
I think this is the right question to ask, and I hope people struggle with this and take your question very seriously. I think there will be some effort by the super rich to protect themselves and their families and their servants from the effects of climate change. You know, you can read now about how the super rich are buying homes in New Zealand and buying citizenship in New Zealand, for example. Another favored destination in this literature, I hate to say it for you, is British Columbia. You know, people looking on the future weather maps to figure out where climate change will have the least destructive effect and buying shelters there and building walled shelters to keep out all of the rest of us who are going to perish or suffer. So I do worry about that, and that's why I think a strong democracy is essential to make sure that all humans have an equal right of survival in a climate-changed world.
What do you tell your college students about all this? Are they ready to hear about climate genocide?
I try not to give it to them in a big scoop all at once, to dole it out.
All right. And what are you working on next?
I'm working on a book on climate change, conflict, and American national security, trying to make the point that, and seeing this from a perspective of military and intelligence and security officials, that climate change poses a threat to global stability, and you can't wall yourself off from that. It will prove devastating to our civilizations.
We've been talking with author and teacher Michael T. Clare. He's the Five College Professor of Peace and World Security Studies in Amherst, Massachusetts. Michael, I know this is a busy time for you, so thank you for spending some time with us.
It's a pleasure to having the conversation. Good questions.
I'm Alex Smith for Radio EcoShock.
Covering the world, this is Radio EcoShock with Alex Smith.
You can't turn on the TV news without getting weather porn. Or maybe it is your turn to experience extreme weather. But is it climate change? We may be one step closer to knowing with a new study in the Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences. The lead author is Dr. Noah Diffenbaugh. His official title is Professor of Earth System Science and Senior Fellow at the Woods Institute for the Environment. Noah has led a key report for the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change. He has advised a previous White House. From Stanford University, Noah Diffenbaugh, welcome back to Radio EcoShock.
Thanks for having me.
You know, for a while, some scientists cautioned against drawing a direct connection between the long process of climate change and single events. Lately, there have been a string of papers investigating the role of climate change, in particular droughts, heat waves, or floods. Do we really know enough to nail it down?
Yeah, so over the last 10 to 15 years, there's been an explosion of research trying to develop methods for objectively testing whether or not global warming has had an influence on individual events. We know that global warming is happening. We know that global warming is altering the climate of many regions. We know that the frequency and or severity of extreme events has been increasing in many parts of the world. So there are many reasons to hypothesize that global warming could be influencing the conditions that create these record-setting extreme events. And what we're seeing over the last decade, and as well as in this paper that we have out this week, is the development of objective scientific methods for testing that influence.
Right. Your paper is titled Quantifying the Influence of Global Warming on Unprecedented Extreme Climate Events. So what general questions did you set out to answer?
Well, so there's a couple ways you can think about how global warming could influence individual events like an individual heat wave, an individual flood, individual severe storm, individual drought. So, you know, one is that there's been a long-term trend in temperature. So globally, you know, that long-term trend is in temperature is what we call global warming, right? The temperature is going up at the global scale. When temperature goes up, we call it warming. It's global temperature, so that's global warming. So there's been a long-term trend in global temperature. There's been a long-term trend in the annual temperature in most parts of the world. So that global scale warming is reflected at the regional scale as well. So if you imagine that a region is warming, let's say California, you know, we know has been warming. All else being equal, you know, temperature goes up, temperature goes down from year to year, but all else being equal, those ups and downs, with a long-term warming, we expect that those ups will be warmer now than they were 100 years ago. So one way to approach this question of what's the influence of global warming on the record-setting extreme event is to ask, you know, has that long-term trend played a role? So just looking at the historical observations, we can ask, has there been a long-term trend, whether it's in temperature or precipitation or some other variable? If there has been a long-term trend, how much did that long-term trend influence the probability and severity of an individual event?
It's been kind of shocking. It was in the low 80s in New York, like summer in April, and a nasty heat wave hit eastern India lately. On April 20th, Pakistan experienced the hottest day ever recorded for the month of April, was 50 degrees C, 122 degrees Fahrenheit. Is it safe to say we're entering a time when breaking records is the new normal?
Well, so what we found in this paper is that for the hottest events, so the hottest day of the year, the hottest month of the year, the record-setting event has been made more likely by global warming at more than 80% of the surface area where we have reliable observations. And that's true whether we're just looking at the historical trend, just looking at weather observations, or if we also look at simulations with climate models that allow us to test the influence of the human emission of greenhouse gases relative to a world in which those human contributions didn't occur. So whether we look at just historical observations or historical observations plus climate models, we find that for the hottest events, the record-setting hot events, that global warming has had an influence at more than 80% of the surface area where we have reliable observations.
I'm trying to figure out where your paper fits in with other new research that's coming out about this. A couple of weeks ago, I interviewed Michael Mann about a paper published in the journal Nature. The title is Influence of Anthropogenic Climate Change on Planetary Wave Resonance and Extreme Weather Events. How does your new research relate to other work coming out in the field?
Well, there's a couple ways that our work relates. One is that there's been a lot of research, including from my group, but from many other research groups around the world as well, looking at individual case studies. So looking at the California drought over the last 5 years or so, looking at severe precipitation that caused catastrophic flooding in northern India in June of 2013, looking at the record warm July temperatures that occurred in the United States, a record at that time in 2012, and we saw all those impacts on agriculture, for example. So looking at individual case studies and trying to test whether or not global warming played a role, that's been the state of the research over the last decade or so, and we've learned a lot from all that research. What we've done in this paper is we've looked globally and we've asked, if we use multiple different measures of the potential influence of global warming on an individual event, and we look at multiple different kinds of extreme events, hottest day of the year, also longer term hottest month of the year, dry, the driest year on record, wet, wettest 5-day period on record. If we look at a number of different kinds of climate extremes, and we look all across the globe and analyze all across the globe, each area of the globe, multiple different kinds of climate extremes using multiple different kinds of metrics, what do we see at the global scale? So that's a different way of asking this question than at the individual case study scale, both of which are important. The other way that our work fits is that what we show in the paper is that we can use the same framework where we're analyzing all the events across all the areas where we have observations. We can use that same approach to look at the physical conditions that happen in an individual event. So the record high moisture in the atmosphere that occurred during the Colorado flooding in 2013, the record the persistence of this atmospheric ridging that occurred in the region around Moscow during that 2010 Russia heat wave. And so the work that's been done on atmospheric circulation and the role of the atmospheric circulation in extreme events, that our paper fits very well with that work as well, in that we're showing that we can do this kind of analysis to test the role of global warming, not just on temperature and precipitation that happens, at the surface where we experience a heat wave or a flood, but also on the atmospheric conditions, those ingredients, those meteorological ingredients that create these rare events.
Well, now, this isn't specifically in your paper, but I know when it comes to wilder weather in the Northern Hemisphere, we'd had several scientists tell us about the increasing role of changes in the Arctic. Do you see that as an important factor?
Well, you know, for one thing, in this paper, we've looked at the record low Arctic sea ice extent. And, you know, the Arctic has seen just tremendous change over the past 3 to 4 decades. The Arctic sea ice is about 40% reduction in the mean Arctic sea ice extent, you know, at the end of the summer compared to the beginning of the satellite era. So that's a really rapid decline. And what we find in our paper is that, you know, very high statistical confidence that the record low summer sea ice extent that happened in 2012 is extremely unlikely without global warming. That global warming increased the odds and the severity of hitting that record low.
10 years ago, some said the Arctic would warm up a lot, but the tropics wouldn't warm that much. But lately, scientists like Matthew Huber of Purdue say there is really no control thermostat. Some places in the tropics will heat beyond human endurance to go outside. Noah Diffenbaugh, what does your study say about global warming in the tropics?
Well, so, you know, we've been trying to understand that the spatial pattern of changes in extreme heat for a number of years. And, you know, one of the things that we found back in 2011 in work out of my research group is that even though the magnitude of temperature change has been greater in the high latitudes than the tropics, the year-to-year variability in the tropics is much lower. And what that means is that it takes less magnitude of warming to move outside of the historical envelope that, you know, that those tropical areas are accustomed to. So, you know, that's been known for a few years now. What we find in this paper out this week is very consistent with that. So in terms of not the mean warming, but when we look at the hottest event that has occurred in different areas of the globe, we find that the influence of global warming on both the magnitude of the record-setting hot event and the probability of the record-setting hot event, that global warming has had a stronger influence in the tropics for both of those.
You are listening to Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith. My guest is Stanford climate scientist Noah Diffenbaugh. And we are talking about new science connecting extreme weather to climate change. Are there places in the world that will be safer, more protected from extreme weather events?
Well, you know, climate change has occurred all around the world already. We've had about a degree Celsius of global warming over the last century, and we are seeing the impacts of that already. And we see that in the oceans. We see that on land. We see that from the coast to the mountains. We see it from the tropics to the poles. And, you know, global warming is here and now. The effects on regional climate are here and now. The impacts on people and other living things, ecosystems, you know, those are here and now. So there's no question that there's heterogeneity in both the physical processes that create climate change and in the climate outcomes. So certainly there are, climate change is not uniform across the globe. And, you know, really because the impacts are not just a function of the physical climate change, but also of the exposure and vulnerability, what is, you know, how many people, what kind of infrastructure, which ecosystems are exposed, and how vulnerable each of those is, we know that the impacts are not uniform across the globe. So certainly we see different flavors in different locations, but, you know, certainly there are a lot of opportunities to build resilience, to catch up with the climate change that's already happened and prepare for the climate change that will happen in the future.
Your new paper was edited by Kerry Emanuel from MIT, who has also predicted more extreme weather. Do you two see eye to eye on the implications of global warming for public weather emergencies?
Well, I certainly would let Kerry speak for himself, for his own view on that. You know, I think that, you know, what we do see around the world and here in the United States is that we are incurring costs year after year from climate and weather disasters. That's been the case for a long time, but, you know, if we look over the last decade or so, there have been more than 80 individual climate and weather disasters that have each caused more than $1 billion in damage here in the United States. So you add that up over a decade, and the loss of life and the impact on people's lives, and the economic cost, we're paying out quite a bit. We're incurring quite a cost right now. So it's clear that we're not adapted to the climate that we have. If we were adapted to the climate that we have, we wouldn't be incurring such a cost from climate and weather disasters. So there are a lot of opportunities for society to better prepare to reduce those costs from climate and weather disasters.
Yes, we used to be told climate change was a slow development over decades or centuries. Noah, do you think a more sudden jump in heating or storms is possible, so we see the change sooner rather than later?
Well, I mean, global warming has unfolded over the last century plus. Certainly the 1 degree Celsius of global warming that we've experienced in the last century is, that's a long-term warming. So there certainly is a long-term component to it. But, where we, feel the climate system most acutely, both people and ecosystems, are in extreme events. And it's clear that extremes are increasing in frequency and or severity in many parts of the world. And it's also clear from research like ours that's published this week, but also from many research groups over the last decade, it's clear that global warming is influencing extreme events around the world, including here in the United States.
Are you still editor-in-chief of the scientific journal Geophysical Research Letters?
I am indeed. I was being editor-in-chief just this morning.
I was thinking that must give you an inside track on a lot of great new research.
Yeah, we certainly get a lot of submissions, and we publish a lot of what we think are excellent papers.
I think it's an important journal, I do. So you've been consistent, Noah, in saying humans are changing weather in extreme ways when we pollute the atmosphere. I remember interviewing you in 2007 about that. Do you personally get any pushback from speaking and publishing about the links between climate and weather?
I think it's public knowledge that there are climate skeptics. I think as a scientist, I think every scientist would say that they themselves are a skeptic. We're our own most stern skeptics, and certainly in my research, I try to be as skeptical as possible of everything that we do in my research group. But it's clear that there are people in our government, there are people outside of our government that misrepresent the state of scientific knowledge, whether they're doing that intentionally or not. There are influential people that do not accurately describe the state of scientific knowledge. And to state the state of scientific knowledge accurately, we know that global warming is happening. It's simply a measured fact about planet Earth. We know that the climate is changing in regions across the world. We know that extreme events are increasing in many parts of the world. And we know that, including from this research that we've published this week, that the record-setting event for severe hot events has been influenced by that global warming over large fractions of the globe.
What can other scientists do now with the study that you've just led as published in PNAS?
Well, I think, we have a framework for studying individual events wherever they occur. A big part of our goal has been to create a transparent framework that clearly evaluates the scientific credibility. We start from the position in our framework that we've published this week starts from the position that global warming hasn't played a role. It's similar to the presumption of innocence in our legal system. The default position is that any individual event occurred because of randomness, occurred because of bad luck, and it takes a very high burden of proof to overcome that starting position. So, we've tried to publish a transparent methodology that is a skeptical methodology, a conservative methodology. We don't want to overstate the influence of global warming. We want to be very confident that there is a true signal before we reject the null hypothesis of noise or randomness. I think that this framework hopefully will provide other researchers with a foundation for analyzing other events. And critically, one of the points that we emphasize in our work and in the paper is the importance of understanding the physical causes of different events and distinguishing absence of evidence from evidence of absence. We want to really be thorough in analyzing all of the possible physical contributions to an individual event when we have these record-setting events that are way out in the tail of the distribution, and that means that they've resulted from an unlikely occurrence of physical ingredients, and our framework provides a way to test each of those ingredients and their role in the event.
Well, Noah, we're going to have to let you go. Thank you so much for sharing your time with us today.
It's my pleasure. I've really enjoyed it.
I'm Alex Smith for Radio EcoShock.
Check out the Radio EcoShock website. We're at ecoshock.org. This is Radio EcoShock.
Now we're going to get a small taste of socially conscious radio from the other side of the world. One of my heroines of green radio is Vivian Langford and her team at the Beyond Zero community. They do serious radio for 3CR, the influential community radio station in Melbourne, Australia, which also broadcasts Radio EcoShock. Vivian recently went to Malaysia to take the pulse of the environment and activism there. I'm just going to play you this short clip.
Tonight we're in the Cameron Highlands of Malaysia. We've been to see a tea plantation which stretched for miles over the hills and up to Mount Brinjung through the cloud forest. It's quite cool up here as opposed to Malacca and Kuala Lumpur where we were sweltering. Our guide showed us all sorts of medicinal plants, and the richness of the forest gave me many questions to ask our guest tonight, who is at Tanah Rata. The Malaysian environment is his specialty, and his name is Mr. Suresh Kumar. So welcome to the Beyond Zero Emissions radio show, Suresh. Can we start with just an overview of the environment here and what's happening to it?
Okay, in my opinion, in Malaysia, it's a developing country. So the government, the current ruling government, thinks environment is a way of, is a business, is a way of making money, and regards to the environmental protection, the forest protection is not in there yet, and the movement, the people's movement for environment is also quite weak in Malaysia, and that also contributes to the environmental degradation and also deforestation happening in Malaysia.
Yes, well, deforestation is going to be the focus because I think in climate action we have to keep the forests intact. So I'd like to tell the listeners about the original people. They're called Orang Asli, and they are the custodians of the jungle, which is very vast in Malaysia. And I know, Suresh, that you have worked to help them. I heard that some of them were nearly at starvation point in 2014 when there were massive floods around Guamasang and the railway from Singapore to Thailand was knocked out. And those people were sort of abandoned, I think. And I'd like to know how protecting them might be a sort of climate action, because protecting them, they might protect the jungle.
I agree with you. I believe in empowering them is a way of protecting the jungle. They are the custodian of the jungle. For an example, two places we are working with. One place is called Lodging. It is in the state of Kelantan, where there's a massive land grabbing by companies for commercial vegetable farm, for oil palm estates, for rubber estates, for mining. And on the other side, we have Sungai Koyan in Kuala Lipis, then the state of Pahang, where there's a dam project coming up, the third biggest dam, hydroelectric dam in Peninsular Malaysia, which will submerge about 14 villages of Orang Asli. So we believe we need to empower them and we need to stop this. And by stopping this, by preserving more forest, I believe it's a way to slow down the climate change happening around the world. Yeah.
Yes. All right. Well, William Cameron gave his name to these highlands, and you were telling me that the tea plantations that came and the lovely vegetable growing that you can do, grow anything up here, I think, they didn't cut down so much forest, though, in the first 100 years since they discovered this cool area. What's happened since then? What's the timescale we're talking about?
In the first about 100 or 112 years, I think the amount of forest being cleared for agriculture was only 1,000. And the following that 17 years, we have about 10,000 hectares being cleared for agriculture. and there is no enforcement, no control by the local government, by the state government on this. This is the massive deforestation, the situation happening in Malaysia.
Yes, we saw that because we travelled from Guam Asang to here by car, and it was just massive. The hills were just denuded, they were terraced, and there were oil plantations planted all around on the terraces, but nothing on the top. So I imagine you get landslides and flooding there quite easily as a result of that.
Yes, I do agree with you, and I think the flood in year 2014 is caused by the massive deforestation which happened on the starting point of rivers, such as the one you mentioned, the lodging in Guam Musang, where almost most of the rivers starts from there towards the sea, towards the Kota Baru in the Kelantan state. So when the forest was cleared in this area, and we had a heavy rain for a few days, and that causes the massive flood which throughout the passage of the river to the sea, and that's why the Kelantan, the whole Kelantan state was under the water in 2014 because of this massive deforestation happening on the starting point of on the hills, on the mountains of where the river starts. Yeah.
Okay. I'd like to come back a bit more to the Orang Asli, because I haven't met any people from them, and I gather that they live in the forest. I believe you've been arrested even defending them and defending these small farmers against the big agribusiness. Tell us a bit about protesting. I mean, how much chance do they have to protest? Is it pretty strict here, or how?
Okay, for Orang Asli, there is 18 tribes all over in Malaysia. That means they speak 18 different languages. And we are working with two of the tribes in the state of Kelantan and in the state of Pahang. And when they came to us seeking for help, the level of deforestation, the level of environmental degradation is already happened. And it's quite bad. So when they came to us, we went to visit their places, and we found that, you know, there's a massive mining companies, commercial vegetable farms, you know, oil palm and rubber tree estates going on, now what we are trying to do is that we are trying to empower the Orang Asli, at least to stop new clearing of the jungle, and also to take back their rights on the ancestral land, which is now have been turned to something else. Mm-hmm. And this is the initial stage, and that's why there is a lot of police arrest, a lot of confrontations going on. Mm-hmm. Because I think the government is quite surprised for the past about 5 or 10 years when they saw the Orang Asli rising up to defend their land. So I think this is the initial stage, and we should work with them, tell them not to be afraid, not be taken aback by police arrest or intimidation, and that's a way of doing it. And while doing it, we do respect their feelings, their thoughts, their ideas of how to preserve the forest, how to preserve their culture.
I want to know about your federal government, your environment department. In Australia, we've got nothing to be proud of. You know, our environment department doesn't seem to be able to stop coal mining on farming land. They give approval for logging. So we've got nothing to show. But what's your environment department here? Do they say one thing and do another, or what happens?
It's about the same for what's happening in Australia. The department is... I mean, there are so many campaigns going on, which seems to be very nice. But in reality, nothing much is happening in protecting the environment, protecting the forest. The department are merely there to legalize any encroachment to the forest, and to collect taxes from the companies, and to regulate the companies on how to make money from the forest and environment. It's not nothing much happening protecting the forest, and we have the Rafflesia flower, which is one of the biggest flower in Cameron, and sadly I think it's almost extinct now, past few years, because of the level of deforestation happening, And today, I was late for this interview because I was involved in coordinating some things regarding the arrest of some of Orang Asli defending their jungle in Gua Musang, in the state of Kelantan. And we don't hear or we don't see any action from the Environment Department to say that what the Orang Asli did was right and deforestation in Forest Reserve is wrong. Nothing, no statements, nothing is happening. And it's quite sad to see an environmental ministry is being so quiet and so passive on the ongoing issues. Yeah.
Well, I'm sure many Australians will be most interested in that because we have the same battle. This is the Beyond Zero Emissions Radio.
Radio EcoShock.
In this interview, Vivian goes on to unveil the complicated climate and energy policies in Malaysia. It's stuff you never hear about. To get the rest, just search for 3CR and Beyond Zero to find this original Aussie Radio, hosted by Vivian Langford. Or find the link in my show blog at ecoshock.org. That's it for Radio EcoShock this week. Thank you for joining us. Here is the song Speak for the Trees by Aaron Abelman and the Earth Guardians.
I feel trapped in the concrete jungle, sinking deeper, I'm going under. Machines come loud as thunder, the earth's resources we plunder, and some people turn away. But I raise my voice and say, who will be left by my generation at the end of the day? If a tree falls in the forest, does anyone bother to listen? This is the people's darkest hour, we must make the right decision. Extinction or salvation, global deforestation, are we the ancient guardians of this long-lost nation? I wasn't born in the year of the panda, I was born in the year of the concrete block.
We can break them.
We can break these locks and chains.
Come on, yeah.
I wasn't born in the year of the panda. I was born in the year of the concrete block.
Uh-huh.
We can break these locks and chains.
We can break them.
We can break these locks and chains.
So let's break them. We slash and we burn. What will we ever learn? The forest catches fire. Small part of us will burn. I'm not the Lorax, but I still speak for the trees. The survival of our forest depends on you and me. Our children, you will see the beauty of the world within them. Since I fade into the sunset, the trees will surround me. Climb into the branches and feel life so profoundly.
I burn into this world as a part of the land. When I climb into a tree, I hold a flower in my hand. One with the earth, sun, one with the land.
We hold the future of our earth in all of our hands. I'll stand tall like a tree in the forest that I love. To protect my only hope, to protect the land I love.
Don't cut down my tree.
Don't destroy my only home.
Don't cut down my forest.
Leave us alone. Your body is a tree like gardenia. Your heart is the seed and it beats for love. You are the baobab, redwood and pine. You are the future in this present time. Your dreams are the fruits of the flower petals. Music is the season, spring the leaf falls. Feel your roots like a living history. When you breathe, it's because you are a tree. So we say to you, an enemy, 1 billion rise for the trees and the seeds. I am life and I am unstoppable. You can't stop us, and the unstoppable, yeah.
Put down our axes for the future generations. Restore our ancient forests. Mass reforestation.